and do me chillin', Anna.
Test, test. Is this thing on? Oh, yes, it is. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the podcast, The Joyful Frugalista, and now here's your host, Serena Bird and friends.
Hello and welcome. My name is Serena Bird, The Joyful Frugalista, and today we are podcasting from Melbourne. Neil and I have been on a road trip and I have a very exciting guest. So I'm here today talking with Late Starter Fire. Hello and welcome.
Hello, welcome to Melbourne.
Thank you. We've had a lovely time chatting. I'm eating Late Starter Fire's fruitcake that she has made from Christmas, which improves with age. So it is absolutely fabulous. And we have so many shared interests, cultural interests, food interests, and of course, fire interests.
Yes.
Yes, very much so. So let's talk about the cultural things first. You had a lovely post that you wrote recently about Chinese New Year, and I understand you have an ethnic Chinese background.
That's right. That's right.
So, you know, perhaps talk a little bit about that. You know, what does Chinese New Year mean to you, and what does that mean in terms of abundance?
My family came from Malaysia. So we grew up as a Malaysian Chinese, I suppose. So we have the Chinese culture within the Malaysian context. But I think it's mainly much the same as how Chinese New Year is celebrated all over the world. You know, there's the lion dance, the best is the hong bao, you know, the hong bao.
The red envelopes with the money.
The red envelopes with the money.
Yep, my kids love that.
Yes, so as children, that's what we wanted. That was Chinese New Year. Yes.
Did you actually get to keep the
yes,
contents?
Yes, we did.
To spend them?
No.
This is the thing. Like,
yes.
I don't know about you, but when I lived in Taiwan, it was always so complicated because you'd sort of arrive, you know, even my ex-husband, he'd been in Australia 15 years when we went back and first Chinese New Year, and we'd sort of say to people, look, you know, how much money do you put in a red envelope? And they'd say, oh, you know, it's not a big deal. Whatever, you know, you feel comfortable with, you know, it's not that important. And so we sort of put fairly nominal amounts in and then found out that people are giving like big cash to our kids. It's really hard.
And that's like a no-no. Sort of you're giving less than what you received. So
exactly.
So my mum used to be quite stressed about it. So I think when we were growing up, there was a rule where if it's just, you know, normal friends, that's $2 was fine in the envelope. And if you were a bit closer, maybe $5. So if you got $10, you're rich.
So in Taiwan, they're quite superstitious with money. So right. It was always had to be like a double. So like, you know, two. Mm-hmm. Couldn't be four because four sounds like death. So
yes.
It was either had to be two or six or eight. Eight, of course, sounded quite good. So, you know, far. Mm. Bar sounds like far. Mm. So number eight sounds like far, which is far time means prosperity. So that's really lucky. So it was always this hard kind of call in that culture. You could sort of give, you know, a certain amount, but then you'd had to just skip the four and then sort of go up and go up and go up.
Mm.
And it was really difficult to judge because people don't have honest conversations about how much money they put in the red envelope.
That's right. So then my mum would ask us after, you know, we've left whoever's house or, you know, et cetera, how much did you get? And then we go, oh, $2. He goes, okay, that's all right. I gave $2 as well.
And some parents would, you know, when their kids got their red envelopes, the kids are like, excellent, I've got, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars. But then the parents would sort of calculate, well, I've actually given out this much.
Yes.
So I'll take that back.
Yeah.
Because it's very expensive.
It's expensive, yes.
It's a very expensive kind of tradition. And
yeah.
Then you would kind of go forward.
Yeah. But no, our mum would take us to the bank and would have to deposit the money.
So you didn't get to spend it on lollies or things?
No.
So. And so did all that Hong Bao money add up over the years?
Must have, but, you know, we didn't have access to it. Like, it was in the bank. It was, we had a bank account book. That's how old I am. I've got bank account books,
you know,
savings account,
one of those.
Savings account books. But yeah, I don't know, because we never, I can't even remember whether we were, I think we must have been given pocket money, which we used, you know, in the day to day and get things from the canteen and stuff. But I don't remember what happened to those.
Well, see, this is a really interesting issue because, you know, I co-parent in a different, a dual cultural context in my children's father's, in their father's household. they are in a totally Taiwanese cultural situation. So their stepmom's from Taiwan, is, you know, Chinese spoken at home. They eat Chinese food the whole time. They celebrate Chinese New Year and other things. And their pocket money from that household also gets banked for them, and they never see it. Their ama gives them quite a lot in red envelopes, but they never see it. However, me being Aussie and a lot more kind of, you know, liberal, when they get their $5 a week of pocket money from me, which they have to work for, they can spend however they like.
You're so nice. And, Such a nice mum.
But it comes with some, you know, it comes with some lessons. If they want to blow it all on bubble gum, that's fine. But, you know, I will say later to them, also, where did all your pocket money go? Oh, so, and what's happened to that bubble gum now? Oh, that's interesting. Have you thought about if you saved all of that up over the year, how much you would have, and then you could buy that laptop that you've always wanted? And actually, my youngest, who's 7, he actually saved up and bought himself a laptop for Christmas. So we contributed, and it was a Kogan one, so it was on sale. So he had to put in $180, but he did it.
Yeah, that's good money for a 7-year-old.
It is good money for a 7-year-old. Mm. So, yeah, so anyway, it's a very different cultural kind of views about saving and investing and money and prosperity. So, and how, in terms of your FIRE journey, let's talk about this. So FIRE, we're talking about financial independence, retire early, but you're a late starter FIRE.
That's right. I didn't discover it till I was 47.
Wow. Mm. What was the light bulb moment? Like, what made you start to think about this?
My age. I basically woke up one morning, early 2018, and thought, oh gosh, this is the year I'm going to turn 47. And I think retirement is not that far away. Mm. And I had no idea what I had saved. I had no idea what was in my super. I never looked at it at all. I had no idea, and I just had this panic, you know, anxiety, and I was never like that with money because I was really quite laid back, and I was good at saving. I would save, but I would save to spend it on something, like I'd save it and I'd spend it on travel or, you know, whatever. But I never, you know, every month look at my statement and worry about where my money was coming from or where it was going, etc. I was really laid back. And for the first time, it was like, oh, I'm anxious about money and I'm anxious about the future.
Mm. Mm. Certainly the statistics about women and wealth as they get older are very frightening. The fact that women in their 50s and 60s are a very large growing sector of homelessness, which is not what you expect. And it's often hidden because they'll couch surf or they'll stay with children or they'll do other things.
Mm.
But, yeah, it is interesting because I guess we're of a very similar generation. There's actually not much difference in us in terms of our age. And I remember at school, you know, the kind of focus was, I mean, I went to an all-girls school and the focus was, you know, women can do everything.
Yes, and, I went to an all-girls school too.
Yeah. And, you know, you can, you know, break that glass ceiling. It doesn't exist anymore. Rule the world with, you know, looking fabulous in your stilettos and your power suits. And those days was with, you know, shoulder pads as well.
I remember those days.
The shoulder pads and the big chunky earrings, exactly, that you had to take the clip-ons off when you spoke on the phone. Yeah, but, you know, that whole era of, you know, you can do anything. You know, you can go to university. You can have multiple degrees. You're going to earn so much money. You know, that 80s particularly was that era of, you know.
Excess.
You're going to earn so much money. So that kind of concept of thinking about, well, how long do I actually want to work for? Like, it just didn't come into my consciousness. I thought I was just going to be having a ball in the workforce. Is that sort of true to you?
Yes. And also because coming from the Chinese background, education was very important.
Mm.
So from young, we were told, you've got to study hard. You've got to study hard because you've got to go to university. This is the only way out. You know, you've got to study, get good grades, go to university, go into profession. And then it's kind of like once you hit that, your life is set. You're okay.
And so you don't have to worry about money anymore because you've tick, 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 tick,
tick, tick, tick, yes. And
done well at school, done well at uni.
Yep. And you're, well, the uni would be in a profession sort of thing. It wouldn't be just be, you know, oh, I like to learn about, you know, anything. You have to be in a profession that they deem, you know, would earn a good income. And then through that, you should be set.
And then you should be set. And then other people probably look at you thinking you've made it too.
That's right. That's right.
And yeah. So what were the first sort of things that you did when you sort of said, okay, I've had this light bulb moment. Like what did you start to read? What did you start to change in your life?
I first listened to Claire Hooper on the Pineapple Project. Yes. Just coincidentally, well, I don't know which came first. And I was watching ABC and I saw that coming podcast. I'd never listened to a podcast ever before in my life and had to look up how to, you know, download that.
And now you're on a podcast.
I know. It's amazing. So 2 years ago, I had no idea what a podcast was. And she made it really funny, hilarious. And I thought, oh, okay, I'm not the only one out there that's kind of in this situation. And that was the first time I heard about emergency funds, about, splitting your income to like 50, 30, 20 or 50, 30, 10, 10 sort of, you know, et cetera, to spend to, you know, et cetera. So and I thought, oh, okay. And then I was talking about this to a friend and she goes, oh, I've got Barefoot Investor at home. I'll get you a copy. And then it was, yes, then it started sort of, and then I was Googling, et cetera, and then Money Mustache and et cetera. And then it all just ran down the rabbit hole, basically.
And you started a blog in the middle of all this.
Yes, because I thought I have to be accountable to do, because I know that when it's hard and, you know, you've got a stressful job and you want to do this, you know, et cetera, that I'm not going to be accountable. I don't have anyone to be accountable to. Mm. And I could just quit whenever I feel like it. But I thought if I were writing about it, and also I felt that there weren't many people in the 40s, well, at that stage, because I wasn't very good at, you know, looking things up and stuff. So the people I found were mainly in the US. They were mainly young. And there were nobody with kind of my situation, that I was single, you know, late 40s. Do you know what I mean? And in Australia, I thought, oh, well, I'll just add my voice out there and see what happens.
I think you're right, and it's really important you do have that voice. And I'm sure there's a lot of your readers, women in particular, who are in a similar situation, who are approaching, thinking about retirement and realising that they're not in the financial situation they are, who must really enjoy your blog. And I know we've both seen the Playing with Fire documentary. Mm. I think you were at the Melbourne premiere, and Neil and I were at the Sydney one, and then we hosted one in Canberra. And, you know, obviously it's a documentary and they want it to be fairly sensational, but it was all kind of, you know, tick, 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 tick. This person retire 30. This person retire 20-something.
Mm. And they're all happy and young, and it was just fabulous lifestyle. And I've gone past that, you know. I'm in my late 40s. I can't have my 30s back.
And so what's your kind of aspirational FIRE target now?
To retire at 55.
55. Based on your blog, you've got another seven years. Yeah. And so how's that journey going for you so far?
Okay, I think when you first start, it's overwhelming. When I found it, I just found it, I had a lot of anxiety. It was like, you know, I'm so far behind. And when you read all the blogs and all these people have done it, and or they're really crushing it, they're earning hundreds of thousands of dollars. And, you know, they could save 90%, 80%. And they already have investments of hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then you just feel, oh, my God, I am so behind that compound interest and all that. I've got to start investing. I've got to start doing this. And it's just overwhelming. And once I had a plan that, yes, I want to retire at 55, I mean, I didn't arrive at that, you know, in the first week. It was probably, it was only last year, late last year when, you know, I came to that and I thought, okay, I think I can do it. Once I've made that decision, once that then things come down, like I feel a lot more at peace because I've got a plan now and I can see that it can happen. Yes, but at the beginning it was overwhelming.
And I can imagine too for some people who are really in debt, and Australia, as you probably know, has some of the highest rates of personal debt in the OECD and, in fact, in the world. You know, there's different sorts of ways of charting that and it always changes, and often that includes home mortgages. So it's not a true representation, but I think it's fair to say that many Australians are struggling with debt right now.
Yeah,
so they're coming from behind the curveball to looking at something like this. So it must feel very, very overwhelming and impossible for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I came at it, I've paid off my unit. So
congratulations.
Thank you. So yeah, that was really liberating as well, because I've always had that at the back of my head, you know, sort of you owe the bank money, you've got a mortgage. So my parents were very debt averse as well. And, you know, we grew up we never had a car loan, for example, and it was drummed into us, you know, you shouldn't get a loan to buy a car, something that depreciates. So the only good thing that, you know, you could get a loan for was basically a house, or maybe if you're going to business, but we were not entrepreneurial background at all. So owing money was a big deal. And my mum would always say to me, when are you paying that back? How far ahead are you? Are you going to pay that back soon? Surely you must have paid back by now, you know.
I'm always struck too that in Chinese communities, I don't know if it's the same in your community, but certainly when I used to be in Chinese speaking communities regularly in Canberra with my ex-husband, who was obviously a fluent native Mandarin speaker, that people would speak about money. Like, we'd go to someone's house and they'd say, where do you live, that house, how much?
Yes.
Is that a good suburb to buy in? Why yes. not? I'm thinking of doing business. Do you think this is a good business or that, yep. or what do you yep. buy?
Yep.
Shares, not so much.
No.
But definitely property.
Because you can see property, and land is important, because that's what you own. You can see that this is what you own. Mm. Yeah, so that's important.
And always sort of thinking about, how do I make this work? Mm. You know, years ago, my ex-husband worked as a mortgage broker, and he managed to get this loan for this Chinese guy from Inner Mongolia. And this guy had a business who was not going very well. They sort of had this view, believe it or not, in that particular mortgage broking business, that anyone Chinese was always going to pay back a loan. I know this is I don't know whether this is still a view, but, you know, the principal of this particular business, right. Who was not Chinese, had a strong view that Chinese would always pay back loans. So somehow, even though the business was failing, they got this through. Anyway, so this guy, you know, no real income, bought this house. Worked out pretty quickly he could have homestay students. So I think he had about two or three or maybe more homestay students from China, and he cooked from them. He didn't run a car. He cycled everywhere. He lived very simply. He paid that loan off, I think, in a year or two. I know. It was amazing. And we lived around the corner from him, and certainly we weren't.
Yeah.
We were doing okay, but we were not paying off our loan that quickly. And we were like, how does he do it? Like, he's not – like, the business failed. He's not working.
Mm.
But just that commitment to paying down that debt. Mm.
And being frugal for that time period.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Exactly.
And just that focus, that laser-like focus.
That laser-like focus.
Mm.
And it's obviously worked for you. How long did it take you?
No, it took me longer than my mum. No. I was a spendthrift. Once I bought my house, and my dad goes, okay, now you've bought your primary residence, you know, all my friends' children, they're all buying investment properties as well. And I thought, no, Dad, I don't want an investment property. I just want to stay in my house. I'm happy. I've got this level of debt. I'm happy. Because I also want to leave. I want to travel. I want to do things. And he goes, no, you need an investment property. But the whole thing of then going out and looking for investment properties, etc., I found the whole house buying process very stressful.
Mm.
You know, and it was a big deal. Like, you know, it was just a big deal to do. I don't know. Some people, I don't know how you had 10 properties.
Yeah, well, you know, ex-husband was, you know, ethnically Chinese, well, actually known from Taiwan. I have to be very careful with how I describe that. And same, like, you know, earning property was really important.
Mm.
I think had we stopped at about 7, it probably would have been okay. I think we needed to consolidate a bit.
Mm.
It's stressful.
That debt level scared me. So maybe because I was also single, and I'm working this job, and then I think, well, what if I lose the job? And then how can I pay for my normal mortgage plus the investment property, etc.? It just got too hard. So I just kind of left it on the back burner and didn't do anything about it. And, you know, now it's way too late to do anything about it. The property price has just, you know, gone skyrocket. it's way beyond.
Well, I guess in Melbourne, yeah. particularly in yeah. CBD,
yeah.
Particularly, there has been a significant price range. Yeah. So yeah. Do you invest in other areas other than your residential property? What's shares. Your go-to?
Yeah, so super and shares, basically.
And so do you invest directly in shares?
Yes. Yes. So before, there was this period, you know, between waking up and thinking, oh, my God, I don't have enough money to retire, to then reading
The Barefoot Investor.
Mm-hmm. So I had an amount of money and I thought, okay, I've got to put it into shares. And I thought, I knew about, you know, being diversified and all that kind of jazz, but I just didn't know what to put it in, etc. So then I read up, you know, with the ASX and stuff like that, and then I thought, okay, I'll just diversify. And so I just chose all the industries and I had one in each industry. I just chose something in the top 200, one in each industry and, you know, each category, and I thought, okay, that's it. And then I didn't know what else to do. I had no other plans. And then I read Barefoot Investor, and he talked about LICs, and he talked about AFIC, and, you know, he would just invest in that and nothing else, and et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, oh, okay, well, that's a new concept. Like, I had no idea about ETFs and LICs and all that. But then as I read, I decided, yes. So since then, I have been putting into LICs and ETFs and just kept those individual shares, as it's like I haven't put any more money into those.
Do you monitor the shares that you do have?
Yes. Yes. Well, as in the direct shares? Mm. Or not really, besides just, you know, knowing when in dividend comes and just knowing what the share prices is, sort of thing. Like, I haven't been reading their reports and, you know, what their profit forecast is, etc. It's just pretty general. Like, I haven't really delved into it.
But was it hard to get started? Was it scary to get started?
I had shares before when maybe after graduation or so, when we first started working, there was a lot of
the IPO, float.
Yes,
the initial public offering.
Yes, that's it, the IPOs. There were a lot. There was Telstra, there was Qantas, there was CBA.
Mm, I remember those days.
Yes. So those were the days. And my dad said, oh, you should buy some shares. So I did. Very small parcels. And he goes, is that all you're going to buy? I go, well, that's all I've got, Dad. Like, you know, because I wasn't really interested. And I just did it because he asked me to.
And those were the days too, yes, where there was a lot of margin lending, where people would take out loans, yes, to buy,
yeah,
shares.
Yeah, no, I was too scared to do things like that. So, no.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's now time. It's the Frugalista tip.
One final question for you today, which is, do you have a favourite Frugalista tip or takeaway for our listeners?
I don't get my hair cut in the shops.
Not, you don't get your hair cut in the shops?
No. I go to someone at home. So it's like a home salon. So they're a lot cheaper than the shops.
That is a good frugal takeaway. And presumably you have a good relationship with this hairdresser.
Yes, yes. So I just ring her and then she goes, yeah, come along, whatever, you know, time, set up a time, and it's quick and it's, yeah, it's, I think it used to be $9 for a haircut.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
I know.
This is like Melbourne prices. I thought everything would be really expensive.
No. Yeah, no, because I go to her house. So it used to be $9, but over the years it's gone up. It's now $15.
Ooh, nearly double.
I know. But that's so much better than $45 when there was once when, yeah, I desperately needed a haircut and I didn't realise she was going away, and then I had to go to the shops and they go, it's $45 for a cut. And I thought,
and that is cheap, let me tell you.
Is it? Mm. Oh, well, it was one of those in the shopping centres that, you know, yeah.
That is quite a frugal trip. So just to recap, Late Starter Fire, her number one takeaway is find a really good home hairdresser who will cut your hair for $15 and save yourself a fortune.
Yes, or be allergic to cosmetics and then you don't eat makeup.
And be allergic to cosmetics and don't eat makeup is another one. I love my bright red lipstick. I think I struggle with that. So, Late Starter Fire, thank you so very much for agreeing to be on the Joyful Frugalista. And where can our listeners find you?
Just on my blog, so www.latestarterfire.com.
Lovely. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Joyful Frugalista with Serena Bird. She actually likes everybody. And, of course, sound has been by Neil Hadley. And myself, I'm Joseph McGrail Baitup, the record holder for the Guinness World Records. We'll be right back.
gotta accentuate the positive eliminate the negative latch on to the affirmative don't mess with Mr. In-Between